Sarah Posner,
Posner.
and this is the Posner Show, back from a rather lengthy hiatus. And today I'm speaking with Brent Sasley. He teaches political science at the University of Texas at Arlington. He researches Israel and the politics of Jewish identity. You can read his work at the blogs Mideast Matrix. He's been blogging at Open Zion and has contributed to the 972 blog. And I guess we'll start out today talking about the nomination of Chuck Hagel to be defense secretary. Sure. And the reaction of that, particularly from the Jewish community. But in a way, I almost hesitate to say that because a lot of the reaction has come from people or organizations that may not represent the Jewish community, if that can be like one cohesive thing. So, you know, we've heard from people like Bill Kristol, and yesterday I was listening to NPR and Elliot Abrams was on and sort of echoing some of the complaints that were made by some people in the Nebraska Jewish community who claimed that in the time that Chuck Hagel was senator there, that he was unresponsive or unfriendly to the concerns of the Jewish community. And of course, they've played up the comment that he made to Aaron Miller, referring to, and he referred to it as the Jewish lobby, which conservative critics of Hagel charges an anti-Semitic comment and is reflective not only of his, what they say is, are his anti-Israel views, but also that that there's some anti-Semitism at play here as well.
So much to unpack.
And obviously, so much to unpack. And, you know, just so that we know what's on both sides of this, you know, there are groups like J Street and I think it was, what was the other group that said they supported the Hagel
Americans for Peace Now?
Americans for Peace Now, yeah, I thought that was them.
And Israel Policy Forum as well.
Right, okay. And AIPAC has said that it's not going to take a position on a presidential nomination that requires Senate confirmation. But all of this is kind of out there now. And it seems to me as, you know, because I haven't done any reporting on this, just because things that I've got going on, so I've been mostly a consumer of the news on this, and it feels a lot like to me that the neoconservative, and I'm using air quotes here, you can't see me, but air quotes, pro-Israel position is the one that's really taking center stage, at least, you know, if you're watching Talking Heads on TV.
Yes. I mean, when everything first happened and you had stories in the Times, the Forward, BuzzFeed, and a couple other places, when Hagel's nomination or potential nomination was first floated, these stories all quoted, they made reference to Jewish leaders or pro-Israel leaders or the Jewish community in sort of these vague, ambiguous terms. But all the people that they quoted were Bill Kristol, the ECI, Emergency Committee for Israel,
which is an organization that Kristol
isn't right one that he has
the...
that he has co-founded.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Josh Block, who was a Democrat, well maybe he's still
and
a Democrat,
the...
but who worked for the Democrats and then has become.
He was the press person for.
He was. He was. He's become really identified with a very pro-Israel Jewish hawkish wing of the community, if you could put it that way. In other words, all the same people who had the same line, who had already all been hostile to President Obama and his policy and had certain ideas about what the best policy was for supporting Israel. There was nobody really from the center and certainly no one from the left who they really quoted as expressing opposition. The only one from the center was Abe Foxman, who in an email had given Jennifer Rubin, blogger at Washington Post, given her a quote that came down pretty hard on Hagel for the comments about the Jewish lobby. But that same day, he gave an interview to the Times of Israel in which he really was far less aggressive and not as directly opposed as it came out in the in Jennifer Rubin's email. And then later on, the American Jewish Committee seemed to be a little bit more opposed as well. But all the other big Jewish organizations, the centrist ones, were quiet. The conversation was dominated by the Jewish hawks of the community.
Well, you know, I guess, I mean, J Street also took a position in favor of Hegel. Do you think they don't get as much play in the press?
They are getting quite a bit of play, and Jeremy Ben-Ami has op-eds in several different places, and they do get quoted. But it at least at the very beginning, I think it's probably less so now, it seemed that when people were looking for a story and they wanted to show that the community or the pro-Israel community is expressing opposition, they went to the loudest voices.
So, I mean, I have to say that in the, I guess outside of my professional life, I know very few people who even talk about or think about or care about what Bill Kristol says about any of this. I'm talking about, you know, other Jews.
Yeah, I mean,
and maybe you have more empirical information about whether I'm right about that. I mean, obviously, you know, in my professional life, I interact with a lot of other journalists, a lot of people who work at think tanks, advocates, activists, those sorts of people. But, you know, in my personal life, the Jewish people that I interact with are, you know, not necessarily, some of them are, but not necessarily in that world as a profession.
Sure.
And there seems to me to be such a profound disconnect.
Yeah, what I think has happened over the years is a de-democratization, and I don't want to say that things have been gone bad because the community is no longer democratic, and that's really really bad, and nobody has a voice. I just mean that at the beginning, when the community was a little bit smaller, a little bit more cohesive, what you would have are the big organizations that represented the national community or local Jewish communities, and then were tied together at the national level. First of all, they only had a couple really big key issues to focus on, which is not to say that they didn't look at other issues, but keep in mind, first, there was the whole, before 1948, the issue of Zionism itself, whether you should support Israel, the establishment of it. Afterwards, a little bit leeriness among the community as a whole about getting very aggressively and actively involved, but the whole issue was still about Israel's survival in the immediate years after its birth. And then, until 1967, you had, or after 1967, there was a sort of a bigger, there was a lot more pride in the community for Israel, and Jews started to identify far more closely with it. And then after let's say the 70s and 80s, you started to get a whole bunch of new issues, a whole bunch of new issues becoming important to the community. And then also there was a bit of a breakdown in the communal consensus. In the previous years, let's say before the 1970s, 1980s, I think, you tended to have the big organizations tied more closely to the local organizations through synagogues, through federations or the equivalent, in which you would have representatives moving around and speaking to different communities. And so there was always this direct connection that people could directly speak to those officers or their representatives from the national communities at the local level. I don't think we see that as much anymore. And so, yes, there is this disconnect between if there's an average Jew, if you ask the average Jew somewhere in the United States who Josh Block is, for example, or who Bill Kristol is and what's his position on Hegel, most people might not know.
Right. And so basically, is it the not knowing or the not, I mean, I guess you talked about the increasing absence of sort of national leaders playing a role in local communities. And has that broken down because local communities don't necessarily, like, they're more interested in local issues or things of local concern? Or is it that local Jewish communities have become less cohesive in and of themselves, and so the line of communication from national leadership, and again, I'm using air quotes because I have some questions about that. you know, is it both of those things? Is it one of those things that's playing more of a role?
If I could, I think it's both. I think the U.S. Mm-hmm. Jewish community is undergoing a number of changes at a number of different levels, at the political level, the social level, the religious level. You have a whole bunch of changes converging. And yeah, and what you just said is exactly part of it. Where we have this breakdown, the Orthodox communities, for example, which are growing larger, are less directly tied or feel that they have less of a direct stake in the national organizations, which is not to say that they don't interact with them. You also have smaller communities. You have communities breaking up into non-denominational societies of worship is one way to put them. You have mm-hmm. new shuls being founded that are much smaller. You have assimilation, intermarriage, which pulls people out of the community, and so you actually do have a little bit less direct interest in Jewish affairs in the United States. All of this stuff is happening at the same time. So yes, it's all happening, it's all converging, and the whole Chuck Hagel thing and the question that you raised at the beginning is actually a very good example, a very good representation of these changes.
So someone might turn on their television and turn on Fox or CNN or MSNBC and get the impression that, oh my God, Jews are opposing the Chuck Hagel nomination, where what you're saying is, you know, I mean, and this would be my observation as well, that, you know, it's not like there's a direct line between these Jewish organizations saying we oppose Chuck Hagel, or we have questions about Chuck Hagel, or we have questions about whether Chuck Hagel is an anti-Semite, or whether Chuck Hagel has said anti-Semitic things. And the only way that people in Jewish communities around the United States are actually getting that information is not from these Jewish organizations directly, or, you know, indirectly through local organizations or their synagogue, but really just from these organizations' very successful media outreach.
Yes, in many cases. I mean, there are still big federations or big shuls that do have, you know, closer ties or more direct access to the big groups. But, yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And it's also not the Jewish community that's opposing it. You do have big centrist groups that are not taking a position. The Jewish public, JPCA, mm-hmm. I'm embarrassed at the acronym, spelling it out as a, it's the sister of the federations, JPCA, uh-huh. And AIPAC, that neither of them are actively taking any position on the Hagel nomination. I'm not sure if the federations are either. So what you do have is those Jewish leaders, or those leaders of Jewish organizations who are opposing the Hagel nomination, are a very small group, a small organizations that are not representative of the community as a whole, and not representative at the institutional level either.
But some of those centrist organizations that you're talking about aren't, I think that the reason why they're not opposing Hagel is sort of strategic. I mean, they do, and they're not opposing Hagel, but they're not opposing Bill Kristol either. They're not coming out and saying, oh, come on, Bill Kristol, give it up. You know, Chuck Hagel isn't an anti-Semite. He's not anti-Israel. Stop mm-hmm. worrying about it. They're just laying low, and there are politically strategic reasons for them to do that. Their silence or their acquiescence is letting people like Kristol or the Emergency Committee for Israel be the voice.
Sure, no decision is a decision, right? On the one hand, some of the AIPAC and JPCA, they don't take positions, and so they're not going to suddenly go out and defend or not defend or
right.
attack any other organization on this particular issue. So they've already have this
right.
is the way they do things. This is their policy. On the other hand, I had a couple of interesting conversations with Ron Campius from the Jewish Telegraphic mm-hmm. Agency. And his understanding is that oftentimes you will get these centrist organizations call out or criticize the smaller organizations or try and get them to tone things down on certain issues at certain times if they think that they've gone too far. On the Hagel issue, it does seem all of what evidence that we do have, and there's not much public or even private evidence coming from the big centrist organizations, except for AJC and ADL, that mm-hmm. people, there's not much evidence that people or these Jewish leaders feel that they really, you know, they love Hagel as the defense secretary. They think he's going to be a great choice. At best, they're probably, okay, this is, you know, Obama wants to nominate him, we can accept that. It doesn't seem that he's really, really being pushed for by these organizations. So yes, you have a little bit of that. And so if ECI and Bill Kristol are saying these very vocal, loud, and frankly, mean-spirited things about Hegel, they're not necessarily right. going to jump up and say, no, that's wrong. You shouldn't be saying that.
Now, it's interesting to me what, his comment to Miller mm-hmm. about the Jewish lobby, that was his term that he used. And Miller himself has defended Hegel, and his use of that term. And a lot of people have defended Hegel and said that, it wasn't an anti-Semitic thing to say. It's interesting because, it's not just, I think a lot of people think of AIPAC or, mainly AIPAC as the organization that really applies the pressure and that members of Congress and administrations have felt that they can't say no to, that they can't go against. But, there is a significant evangelical mm-hmm. presence as well that gives AIPAC, gives these quote unquote, and I use that term very loosely because I think that their definition of pro-Israel is not in Israel's mm-hmm. interests. So, to call them pro-Israel, I wish there was another shorthand term that we could use for them. But they're very much supported by or bolstered by evangelical groups like Christians United for Israel, for example. That's probably the biggest one, kind of in your backyard in Texas. And I think that for members of Congress who may be more familiar with that mm-hmm. world, with the evangelical world, than really being that familiar with the Jewish world, a group like Christians United for Israel helps them make sense or make understand or put into context in their own particular mm-hmm. context what being quote-unquote pro-Israel is and why they should toe mm-hmm. this neoconservative, quote-unquote pro-Israel line. And I think that goes unremarked upon in all of these conversations as if AIPAC is the singular driver of this, which it is not. And so, to the extent that people talk about the Israel lobby or in Hegel's case, the mm-hmm. Jewish lobby, I mean, it that presence in terms of being a lobby force in Washington, it's there. But I think it would be nothing. It would be without teeth, without the evangelical support for the same position.
It's interesting. Sometimes I feel like a Twitter troll because when I see people refer to the Israel lobby, I sort of jump on it and castigate them for using that term because it's just way too vague and ambiguous. And if Ali Gharib ever watches this, I'll apologize because he often bears the brunt of it. But there are all these terms floating out there.
So just to be clear to everybody else, he's the editor.
Editor at Open Zion, and we've had a couple of conversations on Twitter about it. And there are all these terms that are used to describe it. And so, I think Israel lobby is just inaccurate because it implies that these organizations are foreign organizations, but they're not. You're right that the Jewish lobby, which I don't think is actually a bad term to use. The Jewish lobbies used to use this term all the time. And ethnic lobbies are very, very common and not something that people sort of hide and try to avoid using the term for. But Jewish lobby doesn't capture everybody. And pro-Israel lobby is probably better, but even that, what does it mean to be pro-Israel? So right now, there's a strange conversation going on. People are writing about it. A true friend of Israel would tell Israel this or would do that. But, what is a true friend of Israel? What is pro-Israel? Does it mean you support settlements? You support two states? You have to support any of the governments that come to power? Even that term is a little bit unhelpful. At least in the case of Hegel, we might even say the pro-Israel Jewish hawks or pro-Israel neoconservatives, which might capture it a little bit more narrowly in this case. But you're right mm-hmm. that there are Christian groups, Christian Zionist groups, evangelical groups that do work maybe not in tandem with the Jewish organizations, but they certainly share the same, many of the same goals, and their policymaking certainly does converge. Not always. There are not always agreements between them, and not all of the Jewish groups actively work with them, and some of them might not even want to work with them. But they right. do share.
It's complicated.
But the AIPAC, you're right, does tend to be singled out as the particular organization driving everything. I mean, all the criticisms of the Israel lobby, the Jewish lobby focus on AIPAC, and they do leave out the Christian organizations. Maybe some of them leave them out because they just don't see them as part of it, at least in that sort of core area of politics where they're directly threatening or you know, being very, very crude and very direct and aggressive about their lobbying. The Christian Zionist organizations tend not to be in the media as much, or tend not to have that same relationship with Congress as a whole that say, for example, AIPAC does. But you're right. They absolutely do share the same general goals, and they do share the same politicking as well.
But I wonder about that relationship with Congress. I mean, I think that Christians United for Israel would like very much to think that they have the same sort of relationship with Congress that that AIPAC does, or at least something comparable. Mm. I mean, I think that's, and obviously, you know, Christians United for Israel was launched in, I think, 2006. So obviously it's a much younger organization, but the sentiment and the theology behind it has, you know, been around much longer than that. It was just that John Hagee, the founder of it, decided that they really needed to have that sort of congressional mm-hmm. presence. And, you know, they have an annual event in Washington, just like AIPAC does, where members of Congress come and speak to the I don't know if they call them, I know AIPAC calls them delegates, mm. I don't know if CUFI calls them delegates, but the people who come. They have a lobbying day where they all go and they meet with their members of Congress. Now, the difference is, and I think that this is related to why Jewish organizations are reluctant to really, you know, just completely go full hand in hand with AIPAC, is that, you know, I mean, with CUFI, is that, you know, there's sort of two faces of CUFI. One is the sort of, you know, eschatological, you know, waiting for Jesus to come back side of them, which is very much part of who John Hagee is. And then there's the, you know, we support Israel. This is about policy and politics. This isn't about Armageddon. And, you know, people who say that this is about Armageddon are completely misunderstanding us. which, you know, it's like, how are we misunderstanding you exactly? Because you're talking about this all the time and you write books about it. I have a bunch of them on my bookshelf right behind me. But I think that has caused some issues, some tension. I mean, I do remember the AIPAC policy meeting in, I believe it was in 2007, where Hagee mm-hmm. spoke there. And I think that there was a lot of sort of discomfort with it. I mean, I talked to people there who were like, we don't care. You know, that's just some fantasy about the end mm-hmm. times and all the Jews being boiled in a lake of brimstone at the end. You know, he supports Israel and Israel needs all the friends it can get. But then I do think that there was a lot of discomfort around what he had to say about the Jews, about the Holocaust, about the end of days. So I think that has prevented a full relationship with him. But the way I see it is more that, you know, for members of Congress who may come from a district or a state that doesn't really, that don't have that many Jewish constituents, but might have a lot of evangelical constituents, their understanding of this, of the conflict in Israel and everything else surrounding this issue is very much informed by that evangelical perspective that tells them that supporting Israel, again, the quotes, the air quotes, is a biblical imperative for them.
Yeah, I guess I would make three quick responses to that. First is, it's interesting because the Zionist leaders in the United States and Canada, South Africa, Australia, and Britain as well, in all these English-speaking countries, a lot of them had, the Zionist leaders were able, they achieved much success and were able to channel support in the governments of these countries because many of these leaders they weren't evangelicals in the way we use them today, but they were what we might call Christian Zionists, who the Old Testament, mm-hmm. For them, the Old Testament was very meaningful. And so they really did see the Zionists as the new Israelites and the new Hebrews, and they really felt attached to them. And it's interesting that that attachment was important for a lot of these groups in all of these countries, including the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
that the Christian Zionist community is actually far more diverse than most people assume. We all talk about them as Christian Zionists, just like we talk about the Jewish community or the Jewish lobby.
Mm-hmm.
But there are mm-hmm. a lot of differences among them in terms of the eschatological assumptions
yes.
or understandings or expectations.
Yep.
And even among those that share some of those, if you talk to some of them, they will say, we are not, as you said, we're not expecting the Jews to all suddenly die so that Christ can then, rise up in the land of Israel over their ruins. A lot of them will say that that's just not part of what they expect. And then the third thing is interesting. Last year, on my blog, I wrote a piece in which I actually argued that Christian Zionists, the evangelicals, would not have as much power as they do if the Jewish community, if the Jewish community changes, or if things change in the Middle East and the Jewish community shifts away from the Christian Zionist narrative or expectation. I would argue that the Christian Zionist policies, or rather their lobby groups, they would have less power. Because you said that the Jewish communities have some power, or they're bolstered by the Christian Zionist communities. And that, I think that's probably true. But I also think that mm-hmm. the reverse is true, is that the Christian Zionist communities have power because the Jewish groups share a lot of their expectations and assumptions. What would happen, for example, if, let's say, you had AIPAC, AJC, the ADL, if something like Oslo was signed again between an Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority, and then all these groups started to support it and worked toward establishing two states, including a Palestinian state in the West Bank, what would these Christian organizations, Christian Zionist organizations, do? Would they start fighting against the Jewish organizations? Would they tell their congresspeople, listen, don't listen to them. They don't know what they're talking about. Our understanding is more important. You need to stop supporting Israel. You need to fight against this two-state solution. I'm not so sure that they could do that, even if they wanted to.
Right.
And so I think that there is
right.
some vulnerability there.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that will ever come into play, whether or not we'll have the two-state solution at some point, that's obviously a different question. But I think that there are
right,
these different
right.
nuances there.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And also the issue of Jerusalem
right.
in as part of that would play a really critical role just because of the theological reasons they say mm-hmm. they have about Jerusalem being what they like to call the undivided capital
right.
of Israel and the Jewish state. No, I think that that's true. And I do think that Hagee, in particular, has been very successful in portraying Kufi as the leading Christian Zionist organization. While there are, like as you say,
sure.
more distinctions between them, but even within Kufi, I've covered Kufi conferences where I met people who were Hagee is premillennial,
yeah.
meaning that he believes that there will be the Battle of Armageddon and then Christ will return, and then postmillennial people believe that they need to recreate God's kingdom on earth before Jesus will come back. And I've met people of both stripes at Kufi conferences who say that really those eschatological and theological differences between them don't really matter that much because really in the end they support the same things, which is really interesting because it's hard to separate Hagee from what he argues so vehemently in his sermons and in his
right.
books about what happens at
right.
the end. But, to segue from that, it was interesting to me that Rand
mm-hmm.
Paul, the senator from Kentucky, is making a trip to Israel soon. And he was appointed to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he's taking a trip to Israel that's being paid for by the religious right organization, the American Family Association, which really, compared to some other Christian right groups, doesn't really get involved in the Israel issue very much. Sort of interesting development. But I think Paul, like his father, has long been seen as much more not really in the Christian
mm-hmm.
Zionist camp, somebody who during his campaign definitely played up his used his Christian values or his Christian faith as a campaign point, but never in the context of Israel really, and has discussed questioning U.S. aid, foreign, military aid to Israel. And so it's interesting that he's now going to be on the Foreign Relations Committee and is taking this trip to Israel and sort of cycling back a little bit from some of the comments he made about Israel. And I wonder if, to me, it raises some questions about whether his position on Israel within the Republican Party is something that's really like viable. Here it's sort of happening at the same time as Hegel, and it's not like he has said the same sorts of things that Hegel has said about Israel, but it's kind of in the same ballpark in that it didn't toe the Republican Party line. Do you think the Republicans just won't tolerate someone who...
It's interesting. I'm tempted to say we don't know what the Republican Party will look like in 4 years, but there's also a good chance it'll be the same. He had recently given a speech in Israel at an organization, and in which he wasn't as firm or wasn't as aggressive about his need to cut off all foreign aid. But he, to his credit, he stuck to his guns and he said, we just can't afford this. I think that aid to Israel needs to be weaned off our aid, and this will be good for everybody. And he said that other countries should lose their aid first, but eventually we'll have to come around to Israel. So he really was sticking to it.
Well, and it seems like it's a little bit part of his, anti-government spending sort of Tea Party philosophy. But what's interesting also in the context of all of this, which I think has kind of gotten lost in talking about religion and U.S. policy on Israel, is that there was that group of mainline Protestant organizations and individuals who had written a letter to Congress last fall, raising this very same question, questioning U.S. military aid to Israel,
and there, which
anchored a lot of Jewish groups. Yeah, and so it's funny because that has gotten literally zero traction and only served to anger Jewish groups who are pretty much on other issues, other domestic issues. And even other foreign policy issues aligned with mainline Protestants. They have, many Jewish groups have sort of the same liberal, socially liberal mindset on a lot of this stuff. But it kind of seems to have completely fallen off the radar. On the one hand, the Obama administration is willing to take on Chuck Hagel, but that I think was just such a non-starter for everyone, even apparently Rand Paul.
It's interesting because there are also a couple new or rediscovered groups within the Christian Zionist community that are taking the opposite tack, which is that their faith and their expectations and their religious principles require them to, again with these words, but to be more pro-Palestinian or more balanced, and to not, they'll argue that their calling is not to just support Israel by all means. Another thing about Rand Paul is he is still a Tea Partier, or he's affiliated or associated or assumed to be, or a darling of the Tea Party. So their priorities are not foreign policy and not other countries. And so, people keep speculating that he's considering a run for the presidency next time around, or perhaps time after that. If that is true, then the whole trip to Israel seems to be some way to reconnect with the Christian Zionist space of the Republican Party, if that is what he's trying to do.
Well, I think that I think a lot of people view him as a sort of straight Tea Partier. But I do think that he tried very hard to appeal to the Christian right during his Senate run. I remember he went on, Christian Broadcasting Network and made some comments about his Christian faith. But he's not thought of as being a religious right candidate. However, his positions pretty much line up with the Christian right's agenda on domestic issues. But it's interesting, that as somebody who has so tied himself to the Tea Party, or at least the Ron Paul, what they like to call the Ron Paul revolution, and that his position then is we need to cut all this government spending, including foreign aid, that he would then be on the Foreign Relations Committee, which, it's or that you know, we're not interested in foreign policy. We're really chiefly interested in domestic policy and cutting government spending and cutting taxes and all of this stuff.
And that could be a way to do that, putting him on the Foreign Affairs Committee.
Right, exactly. But also, like you said, you know, preparing a presidential run, but it'll be interesting. I'm very curious about the Israel trip because I don't think that he has really, unlike a lot of other Republicans who have made an alliance with evangelical groups, I don't think he has really enmeshed himself in that segment of the evangelical world that's very dedicated on issues relating to Israel.
A smart politician makes sure that he or she meets with all of his or her constituencies, and maybe he wants to be prepared for the next time the Republican Jewish Coalition holds a debate among Republican candidates in which they each fall over each other, trying to say who was at Israel first, who visited which sites in Israel, who bought what trinket from Israel. Maybe he wants to be prepared for that.
Right. But the one thing that we haven't really talked about in all of this is the Palestinians, you know, and the fact that we're talking about, you know, what American Jewish groups think of Chuck Hagel or what evangelicals think of Chuck Hagel. I've got a lot of opposition in my inbox from evangelical groups on Hagel or what evangelicals think of Rand Paul and all that. I mean, the conversation on this issue is, you know, still very kind of confined to this litmus test of what makes you, you know, whether you're pro-Israel. And if you're not pro-Israel, oh my God, you know, you can't run for office and you can't be nominated to an administration post. I mean, so there's been, you know, in that way, there's been so little movement, really, in terms of enlarging this conversation to have like a real conversation about, well, what does it really mean to be?
Yeah, I mean,
is being pro-Israel even the test that we should be applying?
Well, that's why I think the conversation over Hegel has been so misleading or so misplaced. And what does it mean to be pro-Israel? Well, I mean, this is someone who has never said that he wants the state of Israel to not exist anymore or anything like that. He's advocated alternate policies for trying to make Israel more secure. He doesn't really talk about, or he hasn't really talked about Palestinians. For the most part, that wasn't really in his purview. And of course, now as defense secretary,
it wouldn't be at defense, right?
For him. But that's the problem with this conversation, is that there's a very, you know, I wrote a paper with a colleague, Mira Sukharov, for the Association for Israel Studies, and one of the things that we were looking at in the Jewish community and changes in it is this notion of policing the discourse, where you have these new concepts and new ideas and new expectations about what people are supposed to do or be to be pro-Israel. And this is an example of that. And the Palestinians don't play a role in this expected discourse. And that's where ECI, Emergency Committee for Israel, and Bill Kristol and others come in.
What do you mean?
Well, because they, as the loudest speakers, the ones who are getting the most attention, what they say tends to matter more, in the sense that that's what people are paying attention to. And so when they purposely don't talk about the Palestinians or the two-state solution or any of these other ways of thinking about Israel or the relationship with Israel, that stuff is just not covered. It's not discussed. It's not repeated in any of the news stories.
Right, right. So by confining the discussion to that, it's like, you know, wasn't it Gingrich during the primary campaign said that the Palestinians are just an invented people, you know, and it's all part of that same package, like the whole, that as an American Jew, you know, that you're evaluated, your allegiance is evaluated purely on this very confined, what does it mean to be pro-Israel? And then the conversation gets extended to, okay, well, you know, this was kind of the conversation that J Street started, right? Which is like, well, you can be pro-Israel and also pro-peace. And so like their tagline is, we're the only pro-Israel, pro-peace organization, whatever their tagline is, but it's pro-Israel, pro-peace, I think. Yeah. And And that's a kind of all well and good, but it's still reacting to the confines
sure.
that we've been given about the pro-Israel, right? And so, you know, it's like, I don't know what the right terminology is, but it's just kind of like, God, it's so, you know, it's like you're having this circumscribed conversation, mm-hmm. but then somebody else comes along and says, well, we'd like to expand the conversation a little bit, but only within the confines of this circumscribed
yeah.
conversation. And then, like, you're leaving out this giant, there's a big giant hole that gets...
Absolutely. And I know you didn't want to talk about Hegel only, so I'll just quickly add this. And I don't think it gets better. I mean, I'm simplifying because it's that's what you do when you talk about these things. But in response to the ECI people and the Crystal people, you have others on the other side who, because the conversation has been dominated by the criticism that he's anti-Semitic or anti-Israel or bad for Israel or loves terrorists and authoritarian regimes better than a fellow democracy, you have other people then on the other side hoping that he gets elected so that Obama shows that he's not, he won't knuckle under to the pro-Israel lobby or the Israel lobby or whatever term they use, and that it'll be a way to show that we need to change the conversation. I mean, there are different ways to do it. There's a, you know, Peter Beinart's, he just had a long piece in Open Zion about what Hegel
right,
would mean
I read that, yes.
as defense secretary mm-hmm. in terms of shifting the conversation at the broader level. And then you have other people like, for example, Stephen Wald, who have outright written that this is a way for Obama to stick it to the Israel lobby and show that they don't dominate and they can't make decisions for him. I mean, the conversation is almost, it's less serious on both sides in that sense, although I would say it's more or less serious on the among the ECI and Crystal people, but the conversation is just, it's missing so much because of that, including the Palestinians, including
right.
the two-state solution, including what Hegel would do as defense secretary. I mean, all that stuff is starting to come out now, not the Palestinians, but the budget issues, mm-hmm. You know, what would happen to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, what he would do about that. I mean, all that stuff is now becoming more a part of the conversation, but for a long time, the conversation was just not a serious conversation because right away, these groups and these individuals jumped into the gap and started making all these accusations.
Right. I read Peter Beinart's piece, and like I thought it was a little bit too hopeful in the sense that, you know, he seemed to suggest that this would be a really strong sign that Democrats weren't going to mm-hmm. be timid on foreign policy anymore. And I thought that overstated the case. I mean, I do think that there are other political strategies behind Obama's nomination of Hegel. One of them is to, I think, show that the Republicans have just become so unreasonable that they wouldn't even endorse the nomination of one of their own. I mean, even though, like, Hegel, I guess, isn't really considered one of their own anymore, but that's also itself a sign of what the Republican Party mm-hmm. has become. So I actually thought that was, he was being overly optimistic mm-hmm. about what, about if he did get Senate mm-hmm. approval, if Hegel did get Senate approval, what the consequences and the meaning that people would take away from it was.
Yeah. And then also other people have made the argument that Hegel is an independent thinker, a critical thinker, and that Obama's surrounding himself with those kind of thinkers, which would be good for policymaking in general. I don't have a strong position either way on those. Most of my writing or responses have been focused on the nature of the conversation in terms of what it means to be pro-Israel or who is the Jewish representatives and that kind of thing. But you know, there's also an argument that others have made. The New Republic made this, that there's no reason for Obama to even go to Hegel in the first place. That there are plenty of Democrats and liberals who might make good choices as well. Why do the Democratic presidents always have to go to the Republicans? Why can't they find a defense secretary with, you know, the good required credentials among the Democrats or among that side right. of the aisle? You know, that's definitely an important conversation, and that I think is something that is a conversation worth having. But you know, and the truth is that, well, not the truth. The way I see it.
You're allowed
well,
to say
that. I'm a social scientist, so I can't be too
great.
The way I see it is that it's still, and this is actually what you've been hearing a lot from Israel. There have been a couple of voices otherwise that have expressed concerns, but what we've been hearing from Israel is basically that Obama is still the president. He still makes policy. That military and security relationship is very, very strong, probably the strongest element of the American-Israeli relationship. And one man at the top of the Pentagon, is not going to change that or is not going to undermine that and cause it all to crumble.
Right. And I think that that again demonstrates, well, I think that obviously, like, you know, Israeli politicians, you know, they have their own election coming up, but, you know, obviously some of them may be occupying, well, Netanyahu may occupy the same position he occupies
now.
And they have political reasons why they wouldn't want to rankle somebody who's about to undergo a nomination hearing or rankle that relationship in public, right? But I think that also, I mean, I think that Crystal and Abrams and folks like that, or Jennifer Rubin, their position is not really about really defending the position of the Israeli government at this in this context. I think it's more about, like you said, you know, policing the conversation about what it, you know, and being able to put themselves out there as the representatives of what it, the definers of pro-Israel. But I really think that ultimately this conversation isn't going to, you know, and bringing and having like a reasonable, reasoned conversation about the role, you know, who are, you know, having a conversation about not just a two-state solution, not just like a political two-state solution, but about, you know, the Jewish identity as Israel, you know, continues this expansion of the settlements and continues this road, this right-wing tilt, and the continuing this road of catering to the ultra-Orthodox and the desires of the ultra-Orthodox in Israel. I think that the conversation about what it means to be pro-Israel isn't going to be, well, I mean, they're going to try very hard for it to be driven in the political arena and talking heads on cable shows and so on and so forth. But it's really a conversation, I think, that needs to be driven, like you said, you were talking about before, you know, local organizations, but also religious leaders, you know, who I think have an obligation to really open up this conversation and make it less reflexive and less knee-jerk.
Sorry, I'm laughing. I don't disagree, but the first thing that came to mind was, and now the name has slipped my mind, but the synagogue in New York.
Right, exactly. And that's what's so frustrating. So this is the synagogue and the name escapes me too, but they came out with a letter praising the UN.
Yes,
vote,
right. Where the UN recognized Palestine as a
non-member
observer state.
Right. And they came out with a letter praising it. And this is a non-denominational synagogue, so it's not connected to the Reform movement or the conservative movement or anything. And I wish I could remember the name of it. But then they got pushback and then they retreated.
So that, I mean, there are the nature, as I said, the nature of American Jewish society is changing, but also the nature of Israeli society is changing as well. You have big changes in Israel. There's, on the one hand, there's probably some uncertainty. On the other hand, there is still a sense among many that you need to still, I mean, Israel is still part of our identity, so we do need to identify with it and you know, say things about it that are more positive. And then, of course, you have a whole other set of groups that don't feel that way. But, you know, religious leaders are probably caught between these two poles, except, for example, when it comes to policies that the Haredi groups, that are sometimes called the ultra-Orthodox, when they in Israel start to take a greater role in, for example, defining who is a Jew, what kinds of conversions or marriages or what kinds of religious rituals
can
be recognized,
pray at the wall.
Then they become far more involved. Then they become far more involved.
Right, and I think that they become involved when it impacts the religious freedom, I guess, you know, would be one way of putting it, of other Jews in Israel.
But not just other Jews in Israel, but them as well. They don't want the Israeli government to now determine that they are not proper Jews or good Jews or observe the right kinds of rituals. They don't want that as well. And that's why you have seen, beginning of the 1980s, where you have had American Jewish groups play a more important role vis-a-vis Israel in trying to convince the government that what it's doing is inappropriate, it's ineffective, it's going to harm the relationship with diaspora Jews. So, you know, there have been confrontations.
But it's really about intra-Jewish relationships.
Yes.
And I guess they probably feel like they can't go further than that at this point because they need to maintain what they believe is their credibility to even discuss these issues.
That could be part of it,
I mean,
sure.
I don't know. I think that's part of it, actually, but, you know, I don't...
I wonder if also some of it has to do with, the, not to keep harping on, but the changing nature of the American Jewish community. So for one thing, as the big groups move away from the local organizations and local communities, there's a lot more freedom for them to just make the decisions on their own. But at the same time, as you've had these changes in the nature of attachment to Israel, we have seen the growth of these, you know, more partisan groups like J Street or like ECI. And so you have the big centrist groups sort of, you know, caught in the middle. And the conversation where the centrist groups try to be a little bit more careful or quiet or you know, bipartisan, the groups to the right or the left of them don't feel the need to do that. And so they push, you know, their own particular narrow agendas, and then the big organizations get caught in the middle.
Would you put J Street, would you classify J Street as a centrist organization?
Left of center.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I mean, I think I would, but maybe it's just my orientation. Like, I think of them as being very centrist and very middle of the road, but I think I'm probably, I'm to the left of them.
I think of the Jewish organizations, I think of there as a mainstream, and then there are groups on the fringe. The mainstream is big. And then you have a spectrum within the mainstream. I would put J Street in the mainstream, but just on the left.
Right, in the mainstream, but on the left of the mainstream.
Yeah, but
right.
I would call it part of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I think this conversation is to be continued.
That would be great. There's clearly lots that we touched on or opened up that deserve to be further discussed.
Yeah, we will do it again. So listen, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. This
okay.
is a lot of fun.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Thanks.